Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Dean Kuypers. Dean is the author of a book called The Deer Camp, a fascinating study in interesting ways about neighborhood and family and people and nature. I found it fascinating, and we're going to find out the real story behind it all. Dean Kuypers, With Respect. Dean, how are you today?
Great, John. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you. This is a fascinating book that you put out here. First of all, is this truly autobiographical? Because, you know, I've seen plot twists here that are fascinating, and you want to say, oh, this is just made up. He had nothing to do on a Saturday morning.
No, this is all real, and I'm mostly a nonfiction writer. I've taken a few shots at writing fiction now and then in my career, but I'm a journalist, and I've been working as a journalist for 30 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, this was sort of the next work of nonfiction amongst many books that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
Although definitely the hardest one to do, because this one is about my family.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've tried even in my life to write down things that happened to me in a particular case or relationship with a particular person, and I know how difficult it is to be objective and at the same time talk seriously about your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, and all that at a given time. So I found it absolutely fascinating. Now, I also found it to be useful to talk about this book in a context of something that I've been struggling with for many years myself, which is the concept mm-hmm. of neighborhood and the concept of family.
Yeah.
And so we're going to kind of talk about all of that and bring in a couple of other elements. But my first question is this. How did you get into writing? And we'll talk about your family, but
sure.
You personally, how did you get into writing?
Sure. I was a very bookish kid. When I was about 15 years old, I was already doing well in school, but when I was about 15 years old, my father, which is part of the book story, my father came back to live with us and my parents got back together again, and he joined the church, rejoined his original sort of church that he had grown up in as a child. And when he did, suddenly I had a Bible. And I was a big reader and very bookish, and I was reading stories out of the Bible. And we had a great pastor that was with the church that my dad joined, who recognized this and started feeding me books of philosophy. Guys like Francis Schaeffer, who's a big Christian philosopher, things that were way over my head. And but as a kid who was loved a challenge, you know, even at 15, 16, I started reading Kierkegaard, and I tried to read Sartre, which is impossible even today. But things that were way above my intellect and also my education at that point, being pretty young. But books, and also I started reading ecology at that age, things like Aldo Leopold, San County Almanac. I don't really know how old I was when I got it, but it was definitely before college that I've started reading that book. And when I got into school, I thought I was going to be a doctor. So
naturally, yeah. My father was going to be a doctor. He spent 3 months or 6 months in medical school. That was enough for him for the rest of his life and my life and my family's life to become the doctor of the family. I can tell you how to handle that.
Well, I did well in science. So I was a good science student, and I was very interested in medicine. And I went to school for about 2 years before I took a, I think it was either my freshman or sophomore year, I took a writing class. And that was it. My career was ruined. At that point, I was all I wanted to do was write.
Why?
After that.
Why writing?
I loved the language. It was one of the things what I loved, you know, reading the Nick Adams stories from Hemingway, or reading especially stories out of the Old Testament and the Bible. The language of and the poetry of that just spoke to me. I mean, I guess some people are, you know, sort of susceptible to poetry, but mm-hmm. I was one of them. And when, in fact, in school, I had changed schools and ended up going to Kalamazoo College.
Mm-hmm.
And at Kalamazoo College, I pretty much studied poetry. So I have an English degree, but it was mostly about poetry. And that really just, it feels like it suffused every cell in my body.
Well, you know, you talk about religion and the church or religions that you have been attracted by, but this is not a book of religion in the strict sense.
No,
at all. In
no,
fact,
not
it's
at all.
Very eclectic when it comes to all different perspectives.
It's more a book about ecology,
mm-hmm.
and both ecology in the sense of the web of animal and plant relations out there in nature, but also how humans are part of that and how we fit into it.
You know, back in the 70s, I was a member of the Michigan Environmental Review Board. I was appointed by Governor Milliken. And one of the things that he had done as a governor was to create this board that was charged with the responsibility of reviewing all state actions as they applied to the environment. Okay, fine. But he specifically, in the charge given to this board, said that he includes in environment human environment. That
yeah.
is the relationship of humans to one another, as well as to the soil and the trees and the fish and whatnot.
Yeah.
And it really made a huge difference in the thrust of our board's work. We looked at, I remember one of the things that we were looking at was the Pole Town plant over in the Detroit area.
Sure.
And that was heavily human relationships, whether
yeah.
it's business or government and individuals. But at any rate, but your concept of nature here is that human plus relationship to one another, but also to the world around him.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that about Governor Milliken. I sort of remember him as being an environmentally oriented governor mm-hmm. back in the, I was, you know, a teenager in the 70s, but now I like him even more that you've said this. My concept of nature does not exclude us.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with a father who really believed in sort of pristine nature, and one hiker with a bag of Doritos just ruined the whole thing, you know? I think that you can't look at it that way. I mean, you and I are sitting in a, you know, room with microphones. This is part of it as well. Like all of this is nature, and we have to figure out how we are part of it and how we affect it, how the human relationships affect the nature relationships, and also vice versa, how those relationships in nature, the trees and the waters and how they all go together, how that affects us,
mm-hmm.
and especially our minds and our mental health.
Well, I'm going to start off with something which we'll circle back to the physical nature around us, but I'm going to start about talking about your family.
Sure.
As I went through it, I mean, I've read a lot of books, and in my law practice for the past X number of years, I don't admit anymore, don't tell anybody how long I've been doing this. But during that time, I've seen a lot of families or individuals separate from families who have dysfunctional relationships. Holy mackerel. In your family, pardon me, there was a lot of dysfunctionality.
Yeah, yeah, there was a lot going on. And
why don't you tell us about... You know, I'd be fascinated to hear your version of what it was like in that family.
Yeah. Well, it was heaven and hell. It was, I grew up with a father who was really interested in the outdoors. He took us hunting and fishing. One of his first acts as a father was to build me a boat when I was 3 years old. He was a carpenter, built me a beautiful wooden two-seater dinghy that we painted forest green, and he would take me out onto the lakes and we'd catch trout. I have a famous picture of myself when I'm 3 years old that everyone calls the fish story, because I'm sitting in a train station showing my uncle with my hands spread wide apart the big fish that, you know, that we caught. So at three, I was already in. I was into hunting and fishing and going in the outdoors and camping. I loved my dad. He's no longer with us, but there was also a side of him that was, you know, that I probably didn't know very much about when I was younger, but I got to know later when I was a young teen. He had a lot of girlfriends on the side, and that affected the relationship in the house profoundly. And I guess there's no way that it couldn't, but his idea of that was if he had to go away for a few months with some other lady and then come back, he would brook no discussion of that. And if my mom brought it up, he would get mean. And he was a very silent person in the house. And so my brothers, I have two younger brothers, 5 and 6 years younger than me. Our job was to get him into the woods.
Mm.
And that's where things were great with Dad. We would be fishing and hanging out and camping and all that. That's where we had the good dad that we liked. In the house, it was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, too, that in that time period, I had a feeling like our household wasn't that unusual. That there were a lot of dads around in the community who all had varying abilities to talk and to discuss other things that in their lives other than their work. Some of them would go work on cars, and if you wanted to talk to that dad, you had to go out in the garage or and talk mm-hmm. to him while he mm-hmm. had his head under a hood, that kind of thing. And, you know, ours did this in the woods. I just wanted to always, the thing that I thought was unusual about the way that I grew up is I always wanted to have a discussion with my dad about something of substance.
Why?
Like you would, like everybody would. I would like to talk to him about girls or relationships, or I would, or talk about what was going on in my school life, or what should I do? Should I become a doctor? Should I do all these things? I never once got an opportunity to have that kind of conversation with my mm-hmm. dad. He could not talk about anything unless it was, Dad, I was driving home on S Avenue and a big buck jumped over the road, and he'd say, oh, let's go get in the truck. Show me where it went.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put some tape in the tree and I'll see if I can figure out if there's a deer trail there. That was the discussion I could have with my dad. And he was happy to talk about that, but we couldn't talk about anything else. And that is a major source of dysfunction. Mm-hmm. I always wanted him to be able to transcend that and talk to me about something that was of a matter of concern to my young life.
Sure.
Or even my older life when I had a child and all that.
How did you get to the point, and I know this is played out in the book, and this is sure. a fascinating central point of your book. I've seen families where the kids did everything they could to pacify two warring parents.
Yeah.
Or warring relatives, maybe, you know, who somebody who was in the house, a cousin, an aunt, or whatever, and pacifying them so they could be peace in the family.
Yeah,
you hit on one thing, which was, in this case, get your father out of the house and into the woods, and that's fine, right. And everything settled down.
Right, right.
But while he was inside. Did you automatically, were you the oldest child, did
yeah.
you say?
Yeah, I'm the oldest.
So you're kind of the one that learned this practical sort of way of getting peace.
Yeah, I guess so. And we never really had to worry too much about what was happening in the house because my parents didn't really fight in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
So they would just be terse, just quiet, you know, mm-hmm. there just wouldn't be any discussion or dialogue going on. And if there was, my dad had a silly side and he liked to wander around the house, like singing like novelty songs, like Tom T. Hall songs, like Sneaky Snake or, you know, Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, that kind of thing.
Dead Skunk in the Middle of the
yeah,
Road.
Loudon Wainwright. Yeah. Yeah. So there wasn't some tension that we had to break it up.
Mm-hmm.
We just knew that that's where we got the happy dad.
Like,
hey, Dad, can we go fishing this weekend? Can we go? We had the Rand McNally map, and you know, all the green parts on the map were the things that we had circled and X'd on the map with various places we like to go.
You know, we're gonna take a break right now, but when we come back, I'm gonna talk about the world that you grew up in terms of geography, because you've got a local connection for us here in Michigan. But we're talking to Dean Kuypers, who's the author of The Deer Camp, a fascinating autobiographical experience which brings together nature and family and individuals and some in ecology, just a fascinating melange of things. So, this is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we'll be right back. With Dean Kuypers, who is the author of The Deer Camp, a really interesting book about ecology, about nature, about family, about growing up. It's a coming-of-age book, in a sense.
Yeah.
But it's also directed towards an end, and we're not going to be a spoiler here, although in a way you could in this particular case. It's just a unique book. This is not a murder mystery in which the killer confesses at the end.
Right.
So this is John Smetanka. Now, Dean, when we were talking, I said that you were a product of an area. What was the area that your young years and maybe today's years focus on? Where did it come from?
Yeah. Well, the Kalamazoo area is where my dad was at Western Michigan University. And we lived in Kalamazoo. And then when he was done with school, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. And we moved out southwest of Michigan to the Matawan area. Mm-hmm. So actually not far from where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it was an absolutely wonderful place to grow up, because we were out in a very rural area. When I was about 15, my father built a house out there. Near a place called Little Pawpaw Lake, and it was just woods and lakes and cornfields and not that many houses and not that many people. And we were free, probably like kids are not free today, mm-hmm. to roam the fields. And, you know, the only rule was come home. You know, after dark, don't make anyone worry about where you are or if you're out on the lake or some kind of thing. That was pretty much our only instruction.
When my brother and I were growing up, we had pretty much the same thing, whether it was in Illinois where we were during the school year or in Michigan during the summer. It just was accepted. You were going to go out and play in the woods, or we built tree houses, and we found vines that we could swing on, and bless their souls, my parents, who were loving parents, I mean, they did actually love us, said, all right, be home for lunch or be home for dinner.
Right.
And you had a chance to be creative, to live in worlds that when you get old, you don't get to do.
Yeah.
You don't
or maybe be just because the world changes, you don't get to do.
Yeah.
Because I know that my kids haven't been able to experience that the same way that mm-hmm. I did, and I don't think too many of them do anymore.
And that's sad.
Yeah.
I think it's very sad.
Yep, it is.
So you were raised in the Kalamazoo area, but you've moved to various parts of the country you talk about. Where?
Yeah.
What brought you out of this
when
area?
When I was at Kalamazoo College, I knew I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be a journalist. I was interested. I always wanted to be the guy who worked for Rolling Stone magazine but wrote about politics or the environment. Yeah. And every once in a while you do a music story, but mostly you do these sort of newsy culture mm-hmm. stories about the environment. And that's pretty much what happened. I went to New York. I got an internship with a magazine called Ear, which doesn't exist anymore. But it was a new music magazine, and their board was guys like David Byrne and Peter Gabriel and Laurie Anderson, people I was really fascinated by, mm-hmm. and experimental music. And my first piece was about a guy who is a classical accordion player, whose last name was, it was William Schimmel was his name, and the second piece was on Sonic Youth.
Mm.
And they kind of took off from there, and I wrote a lot of pieces about music, but in about a year, I wrote my first big piece on environmental politics, and those have been the sort of twin poles of my journalism work all these years.
But in the book, you talk about your time in New York, and it's not downtown Manhattan that you lived in. It's not the high rises overlooking Central Park. It's a different part.
Oh yeah, it's a way different. And this was the late '80s in the Lower East Side in the East Village. And that was an area that was largely abandoned over the 50s and 60s and early 70s. And there was a lot of squats when I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all the area all around Tompkins Square Park was full of apartment buildings that were empty. And, with people running hoses up the walls and electrical cords building to building to make everything work. You wouldn't be able to believe that if you went to Manhattan now, because that changed so quickly.
Yeah.
But I was there in the late 80s, and in 88 there was a giant riot there that they tried to close Tompkins Square Park at night. And mm-hmm. it was a place where people went at night, including me. I liked to just go there and sit because it was a little piece of nature in the middle of Manhattan, and the local community board and the police and stuff closed the park one night, and the entire neighborhood fought back, and it turned into a police riot, and it was brutal, and I got beat up pretty badly by police. I was reporting, although it may not have been evident. I wasn't wearing an official like New York Times badge or anything. but that definitely changed the character of the tensions in that part of New York at that time, and they kind of backed off for a year or so, but then quietly closed the park, and then it almost immediately started changing to condos and the high rises and the fanciness that we see today. So it was a different sort of dirtier, a little meaner New York.
Well, you're also talk about your kind of transmogrification from a kid from the Little Pawpaw Lake.
The Sticks.
Into Manhattan.
Yeah.
And into this area, which was a neighborhood in great turmoil.
Yeah.
And you were right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And this, as I read the book, it's fascinating to watch how you in a, I'm going to be careful of the choice of the word, but I'm going to try it anyway. Radicalization. It changed you.
Yeah.
And it gave you a different perspective on the environmental movement and the environment that you had grown up in.
Yeah.
How did that happen? I mean, what was it about?
I was always really grateful for what happened in Michigan when I was growing up, because it got cleaned up. A lot of people wouldn't know today probably for that in the late 60s, the Rouge River would burn, and it was a very polluted place, decades of industrial, heavy industry in Michigan. And around in the early 70s, the big laws came in, like the Environmental Protection Agency was created, and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act, and these things came in, and it got cleaned up.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I was out of high school in 82, there were millions of deer, and there were, the rivers were clean enough to have trout in them again, and it worked, and I saw it happen before my eyes. Later in the late 80s, I was very interested in groups that were taking that further, that were the so-called radical environmental groups.
Mm-hmm.
like the sea shepherds who would go out in the oceans and try to stop people from killing whales. And if they didn't stop, they would physically intervene by like putting their boat in the way or trying to do something to get between themselves and the whale, that kind of thing. Greenpeace tactics, basically. And I did a lot for about 6 years, 8 years. That's all I did was report on groups like that because I saw this was the new front in environmental action. People were taking it. First, there had been the laws, and now these people were taking it to another step. I did not participate in these things because as a reporter, I always had to keep myself separate from subject. But I liked being there, and I also, even when I went to New York City and later ended up in San Francisco, I liked finding, I was looking for nature, basically. That's why I was hanging out in Tompkins Square Park in the middle of the night. I was looking for any little piece of nature that was anything like where I had grown up in the cornfields outside of Michigan. That still, that even though I had gone to the city to look for this built environment and to try to figure out politics and try to figure out the human ecology, basically, I was still looking for wild nature wherever I could find it. And a lot of those radical environmental people were in camps in the Redwoods and or were in, you know, the Rocky Mountains doing actions to try to stop, you know, a bear, a grizzly bear hunt or some kind of thing like that. So they're always in these places that I really wanted to be. So I liked going to report on those folks because then I could pitch a tent next to my motorcycle and I could like hang out there for a week.
How is your relationship with your family? Now, you've talked about your dad. You haven't talked yet about your mom and your brothers. I'd like to tease that out a bit.
Yeah. Well, dad was kind of in and out of our lives as we were younger, and my mom was just a rock. She was fantastic. She was always there every day. She, you know, she had to work a lot while we were in our teens, especially when my dad and her were separated. But she was always there for us every day, and still today, to this day, we're very, very close. And my brothers as well. My brothers and I still hang out together at every possibility. On the cover of the book, that's the three of us fishing. And so I really feel fortunate that we've always had a great relationship. And working on this book has made it, I think, a little even closer.
Well, I can see why. I see as you wrote about your brother Joe and your brother Brett and about yourself, I can see the developing relationship and how your relationship with your mom, your dad, nature, and the and your brothers and your brothers really was a like a DNA molecule. That is, it was twisting and twisting, but it's all interrelation. You know, the appearance and the actuality of the various relationships, very complex.
Indeed, yeah. When I was younger and I was reading and before I got to college and then into college, I was reading a lot of ecology, as I mentioned, and I've always been fascinated by that. How is nature woven in to our relationships? How, you know, my brothers and I, when it was time to be together, we head out the door and we would go do whatever we were going to do outside, go to the lake or like look for a frog or these kind of things. That was always part of who we were. And it was more important than just a place to go. I realized as I got out of my college years and was starting to work as a reporter, and especially reporting on some of these radical folks, I was realizing that it was more a part of our family than just like some other people would maybe go to the mall or go to a bowling alley or go do other activities where their family would be together. There was something about going out into the living world that was more than that. It was more than just a place to go. It was something that was giving back to us in a way.
One of the things that you emphasize in this book is just the point you made, which is that for you as a person, and now you're talking about it as you and your brothers, nature was not static.
No.
It was not just a rock sitting someplace.
Right.
Even rocks, in a sense, and I don't want to, I'm not trying to extend this into something ridiculous, but even the rocks would talk to you in a way.
like one of the great last lines of A River Runs Through It from Norman MacLean. You know, he talks about the stones under the creeks and some of the voices were theirs.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are talking to us in some way. We are in a dialogue with mm-hmm. all of the material world, the nature around us. And I think most of the time we just tune it out. And if we're open to it and we can tap into that, their nature is, the way I look at it, is a communicative order.
Okay.
We always talk about ecology as the web of life, right? Mm-hmm. And so that web is, the strands of the web are a communication between this flower and that bee, or, you know, this tree and that tree through the little fungal threads that go underneath the humus of the forest. There's talking going on
mm-hmm.
everywhere. And
there's a book on that, The Life of Trees, as I recall.
The Secret Life of Trees,
yeah.
Peter Wohlleben, German guy.
Yeah.
It's a great book.
We're going to take a break now, and we'll be coming back to this very topic, which is communication and what does nature teach you and us, in just a minute. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we're talking to Dean Kuipers, the author of a fascinating book called The Deer Camp. We'll be right back. Back on With Respect with Dean Kuipers, who is the author of a book, The Deer Camp, which is autobiographical, telling about his life, his family, his tough points, the good points of his interrelationship with his family, but also the relationship that all of them has had and have with the world around them and around him. This is John Smetanka. So, Dean, when we broke, we were talking about the trees are talking to each other. And I'm not being facetious, because this is the book, the Secret Life of Trees, brings this out. There is mm-hmm. a relationship that is formed at some level between trees in the same neighborhood.
Right.
And the spider webs have the interesting texture of being on several different points tied to the physical world, but as a vehicle, as a way of maybe catching prey, food, or just getting from one place to the other.
Right, right.
So right. It's the Spider-Man played out in reality.
Right.
What have you gotten from that conversation?
Well, one comment first, probably about the conversation itself. One of the guys that I really liked to read starting when I was in college was Gregory Bateson. Not super well-known ecologist, but an ecologist. He was married to Margaret Mead
mm-hmm.
and started as an anthropologist in World War II, studying those more primitive cultures in Papua New Guinea and things like that mm-hmm. with her.
Later, coming of age in Samoa, no, or Tahiti.
Yeah, yeah.
Coming of Age is what the book she wrote.
Right, right. And they, both of them were also involved, strangely, in the development of the computer. During World War II, they started developing, when people started developing things like missile tracking or, mm-hmm. guidance systems and things, that was the birth of the computing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both heavily involved in discussions around that. There was a whole series of lectures called the Macy Lectures, and they were part of that group. Mm-hmm. Later, when he was an ecologist, someone asked him, and it always stuck with me, does the computer think? And he said, oh, no, the computer doesn't think. It's man plus computer plus environment. That is the entire trial and error loop that is thinking. And he said, it's the same if you take out the computer out of that calculation or out of that scenario. It's man plus environment is what thinks. That's mm-hmm. the thinking, the total entity that thinks. And that stuck with me because I realized that, you know, if we go back to Descartes, I think therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I always knew that that was wrong. And I thought, oh, well, then what it really is it thinks, therefore I am. Or we think, therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a group activity.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And so it is out there in the woods. And when I started in as a reporter and was spending a lot of time in nature, which I still do to this day, those kind of thoughts stuck with me. That inhabited me, really. Like, all of this is talking. It has something to do with my own mind, my own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Can't happen without this whole world out here around me. And what is it bringing back to me? And to answer, you know, to get into your question a little bit, what it brings to me is a sense of group feeling that I have about the world around me. I don't feel like I walk through it as a single entity that is detached from everything. I just feel like I'm moving through this world in a way that is where I'm connected to everything in some way, even if I don't want to be, I mm-hmm. am. And so all of my actions affect the natural world and the human world, and all of its and their actions affect me. So I have a responsibility. I've always felt a very heavy responsibility to do something
mm-hmm.
and to, if there's a situation like, you know, the Rouge River catching on fire when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
Or the Cuyahoga or the Chicago or the Buffalo, you can name a lot of rivers that used to burn, that we need to do something about that, because one of the other things that Bateson said was that that's a form of mental illness.
Hmm.
Not only ours, but the wild world being driven crazy by our action.
Just as, for example, we consider someone who kills another human being, that's in the highest level inappropriate. It's bad behavior.
Yeah.
You're taking away from that other human being, unless you have darn good reason. And that's where there's another sort of a blending of circumstances in which in wartime or self-defense or defense of others,
yeah.
There may be a justification. However, when you're talking about nature, it seems to me that also is a very textured relationship because, for example, we have trees, but we build houses out of trees.
Right.
We have crops. We have corn. We have alfalfa. We have soybeans. All of these have a life outside of us.
Yes.
But they're also with us. And
that's
they
right.
And we affect them, and they affect us.
That's right.
All of that is, but then you get to a completely bizarre relationship, and that is, okay, you've got a river. Rivers have water. They have a life, in a sense. They have yeah. life inside them. They have fish. They have algae. They have all this sort of stuff. People relate to it by looking at it. And then, you know, we have in literature, many of the books that were great novels are written is about people who look upon a river as life passing. Or
sure.
we talk about life being a river.
Sure.
However, when you get to a burning river, that's not really what we
yeah.
that I think of in terms of a natural consequence.
Yeah, right. We want to what the world around us, I think it delivers to us. It sends us messages of what is right. What is its
mm-hmm,
rightful
mm-hmm,
state?
Mm-hmm.
And some of those, as you pointed out, are tricky. For instance, I hunt and fish.
Mm-hmm.
And on our place, I feel good about our relationship with the deer because we do a lot of habitat management
mm-hmm.
where basically we grow them.
Mm-hmm.
We give them, they don't have fences or anything. It's not some kind of high fence operation. But I feel good about the fact that we do a lot of work on their behalf. And then once in the fall, we probably take one deer,
mm-hmm.
Off our property, an average every year.
All right, now let's get to that, because that really is, when I was going through your book, I kept saying, but wait a minute, he's into hunting and killing, killing
sure.
deer.
Yep.
Otters, or it was not. It was muskrats. Muskrats. Yeah. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. There's got to be. I've got to get an explanation from this guy. How taking a life is a part of your natural interrelationship with nature.
Yeah. Well, we're as Paul Shepard, another great ecologist, pointed out in his wonderful book called "The Sacred," the tender. Wait. I forget what the title is.
All right.
he pointed out that we are Pleistocene creatures. Our brains were formed in the Pleistocene when we were hunters and gatherers, and we killed woolly mammoths, and you know we started to eat meat for our survival, and we still are. And I don't buy any like beef out of the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
What I do is I have this piece of property, which I am so fortunate to have, and most people don't have that. I recognize that, where we can grow a deer and I can kill the deer, and the meat I'm going to eat that year is going to be that deer.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is a much different relationship than the commercial relationship of us going to the supermarket, where it becomes this disembodied package, literally disembodied, mm-hmm. of you know, a red slab that's mm-hmm. nicely wrapped in plastic, and then we take that home. That I find that difficult to deal with.
The other one that I find difficult, and I know that I'm going to offend a listener in this program, but I'm struggling to understand the concept of putting heads on a wall.
I'm struggling with that too. I don't endorse trophy hunting. It's something that I find really problematic. I think that the hunting media, which is something that there's a lot of guys out there and gals out there whose work I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I really like Stephen Ranella, who is the Meat Eater podcast and TV show. I think he does some good things, and his cookbook is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes the hunting media does themselves a big disservice by showing the person packing out from the wilderness with a giant set of elk horns on the back,
mm-hmm.
and no meat. Where is the meat? Like most people who do hunt take the meat and use it and so forth. But
what
we often see emphasized is, I'm walking out of the forest with this giant ram's head on the back of my backpack because I took the horns.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we were really honest about it, you'd leave the horns in the woods and let the porcupines chew them, and you would take the meat home.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is a lot of trophy hunting that goes on where, especially now where there's high fence operations where people grow these gigantic, atypical, you know, 22-point deer. And you can actually shop for them beforehand, before you even go. Oh, I want that one, you know, buck number A15 or whatever. And then you go and they sort that one out, and that's the one you shoot. That, to me, is ridiculous.
Well, some of my friends, and I have a kind of a wide range of friends that are of all different backgrounds and interests. However, some of them are very into trophy hunting, all right? And I'm struggling. I tell them I struggle with this process.
Yeah.
Now, in fairness, just as I struggle with other people's political points of view, I am struggling. That is, I want to know.
Yeah.
I want to know what's behind that. What is the depth, the psychological importance of doing this? And I'll accept that they are doing it in goodwill. And that they have a reason, deep reason.
Yeah.
It is just difficult for me. That's all.
I don't like the. I don't appreciate the collecting aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a particular antelope that only grows in Asia that I don't have yet, so I have to go get one of those.
Mm-hmm.
That it's turned the animal in its own ecological importance in the place where it lives into an object that just needs to be that has. Become something else and been pulled out of its environment and put into a human context that is has nothing to do with the animal actually growing and living and being part of planet Earth. It has to do with being sort of on display somewhere at someone's house.
Dare I say that you look on it as a burning river?
Yeah, it's a burning river. Yeah.
All right. Now, your book is not just about nature, and it's not just about your dad or your brothers.
Right.
But it's a comprehensive and long-looking trajectory of a family.
Yeah.
And how they struggle with themselves.
Yeah.
And their own demons. Everybody has demons.
Yeah.
Your brother Joe was, you talk about things that his demons and how he worked to overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. And it's all, and your dad. But it all came together, sort of at a little bit of an omega point, to quote Teilhard de Chardin.
Sure. Yeah.
Tell
one
us
of
about,
my favorites, by the way.
Is it?
Yeah.
They are? Oh, you like yeah. The phenomenon of
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Or the divine milieu is one of his books. There's a perfect example. One of my aunts gave me that book for Christmas when I was 12. Well, I'm, hello.
Right. It's pretty heavy for a 12-year-old.
Pretty heavy. But you know, I got into it, and damn, I knew it was over my head, but it stimulated my thinking.
Right. Right.
And I look back and I thank that aunt, who in many other respects I wasn't close to, but she gave me books that certainly 12-year-olds or 13-year-olds didn't get, but she gave them to me. Dr. Zhivago, when it first came out, Divine Milieu. This is the point I'm making here is somebody challenged you. And someone challenged me.
Yeah.
And that challenge changed our lives.
Yeah.
Before we get into those where that trickle of conversation goes, let me take a break. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect. And we're talking to Dean Kuipers, who is the author of The Deer Camp, a fascinating autobiographical book about the interrelationship between nature and his family and himself and the rest of the world. This is John Smetanka. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dean Kuipers, who is the author of The Deer Camp, an autobiographical work of nonfiction, obviously, and it is fascinating, and I recommend it to people. Surprisingly, I couldn't put it down. So, this is John Smetanka on With Respect. Dean, family.
Yeah.
Personal development. Struggles. How did it all work out?
I wrote this book because my dad changed. And it was such a remarkable change that I knew almost immediately, as soon as I was sure it was a real change, I wanted to write about it. As we've been talking about here, you know, our family struggled to be together as a family. My parents broke up and came back together, but it was always very sort of tenuous. Eventually, my mom divorced my dad in 88. That was right about the time when I moved to New York City. And it's embarrassing for me to say now, but at that point in my life, I would tell people that my dad was dead, which as a father now, I have a 19-year-old and two stepsons, and that's horrible. It makes me feel so... like I want to tear my teeth out to think that I could have gotten that far away from my dad that I thought, you know, it was okay to tell people he was dead. He bought, after the divorce, he bought the deer camp. He bought this property with my uncles, and it was a way for him to spend time with his brothers, but also a way to kind of bring us back to him because we had been raised hunting and fishing. And we went there. My brother Joe, who was, as you pointed out, struggled more than I did and more than my brother Brett did. He was drinking a lot when he was in high school to the point where he was an alcoholic. And he had gone into a rehab, thankfully, because he did pull out of this. By the time he was in his mid-20s, he was okay. But he was in a rehab when he was about 19, and I went out there to see him, and he got out for a couple days, and my dad suggested we all go to the deer camp, which we had kind of tried to resist, actually. Mm-hmm. And we went up there, and Dad presented us the rules and kind of how it was going to be up there, and it was a beautiful place, but it was not that nice to be there with him. So we stayed away from it. I didn't go back there for another seven or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Later, in the late 90s, early 2000s, my brother Brett kind of herded us all back together again and suggested that we do some work on the property because it had been an old farm. Like a lot of places in Michigan, they had cut all the big trees off it in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, and then it had been farmed, but only briefly, before it just was basically exhausted and was sand, like almost like beach sand.
Hmm.
So there was pine trees coming out of it, but it was sand, and it needed some work. And Brett said, hey, we can make this place good for bird hunting if we take out some of these old pine plantations and we do some pretty heavy work up here. I was all for it. Joe was all for it. My dad was resistant. Finally, in 2003, he let us take down a big chunk of the forest there. That was an old pine plantation, kind of scraggly old 50-year-old Scots pines. We took them down, and that summer was sort of the worst of our summers, at least in my estimation. My dad was depressed because we had taken the trees down, and he was convinced nothing else would grow. He had lost faith in the power, actually, of the earth and that it, and its ability to be restored and to mm-hmm. rehabilitate itself. And the next spring, I was out there doing some reporting on a story in Michigan, and I got a chance to spend a couple days in our cabin. So I went up there. And a new forest had come out of the ground, as of course it would, because that's what happens when you clear a piece of land. Things, you know, weeds pop up almost immediately, and trees were popping up. But it was aspens and primarily growing back, and, you know, those grow fast. So the first year they were already 3-4 feet tall, and my father changed. He greeted me with a hug and a kiss and said, I love you, and I'm so happy you're here. Look how beautiful it is here. And he had the cabin thrown wide open. And, you know, originally his approach to having the cabin was he'd always keep the blinds closed and keep the lights off so the deer wouldn't know you were there and stuff. It was always sealed up. Like, he kept the outside from getting inside.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the cabin wide open. All the windows were open. And there was these beautiful trees growing. And basically, from that spring forward, he was 59 or 60 years old. So other things are probably happening in his life. But from that spring, we got a different dad. And all of those things I had been studying all those years, you know, guys like Gregory Bateson telling me that it was man plus environment that thinks, immediately my mind went to, oh, it was the trees. That it was the first time that all of us, but particularly Dad, had to grow, like I was saying, he had to grow a deer instead of just go out in the woods and shoot one. He had basically not wanted to participate in the forest. He just wanted to take, kind of reach out there lightly and pluck one bird or one deer and not really be hands-on with the management of the environment. And this was pretty hands-on. We took down a forest. We planted like 600 berry bushes one spring. We were doing a lot. We were growing some fields of rye, trying to grow deer plots and that kind of thing. We were doing a lot of work. And from that spring forward, we had a different dad who wanted to participate with us, who wanted to talk about anything that you wanted to talk about. And if we had ideas of stuff we wanted to do on the land, he was wide open to it. It was my brother, Brett, in particular, was just over the moon. He said, you know, all my life I would try to sneak up here to go to this camp without him so that I wouldn't have to be up here with him because it wasn't very pleasant. And now all I want to do is be here with Dad because it's so great. And I knew I wanted to write about this. Probably around 2008, 2009, I started talking to my brothers about it, about the sort of ecological bent to the way that I wanted to write about this, about the impact of us growing these trees and how that was the time when Dad changed. And they were fascinated by that and said, yeah, this is, that seems worth writing about. And then my father passed away. So in a way that made it easier to write about, because I didn't have to confront a lot of the negative stuff with Dad, but I would have, and it would have been a different book for sure, because mm-hmm. I would have had to ask him about the other ladies and all the things.
Sure.
That would have been, and I could have done it, but it would have been really difficult. Because going back into your family that way and saying, why did you do these things when we were young? That's really difficult for most families to do.
I remember one of my cousins who, for a writing project, came over to from Wisconsin to sit down with my dad for an interview about a psychological history of our family.
Oh, wow.
And I left them alone. But I heard questions asked occasionally as the they spoke more audibly. And I heard him talking about feelings that he had or that other members of the family had, which stunned me.
Yeah.
Because he had never shown that side of himself to us. And it was really, really worthwhile, even though I was not part of the conversation, to hear some of that. It was very worthwhile.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you, I'm not going to push you any further on telling about all the interesting details and anecdotes and whatnot that flow pretty clearly in a direct line to some conclusions at the end. I leave that to the people who read your book. But
thank you.
I would say that it is, from my standpoint, it was a worthwhile read, very worthwhile, and that I was drawn along to the conclusion. But I'll tell you, you may not realize it, but there is a second book here.
My publisher is going to be so happy to hear you say that.
There is a second book here, and I'm not going to tell you what it was. I'm going to let you and your publisher work that out. Other than to say, there is a point after your father's passing at which the family took the root of the trees that came out of where you had done a clean, mm-hmm. Clean cut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going off somewhere. And you and your brothers and your mother and all the other people, and there's many, many people involved in this story that you have.
Yep.
And you tie them in interestingly. I mean, it's almost, in a sense, like reading a Russian novel, for pity's sakes. There's Boris and Natasha and so on and on. And you have to use two names, Boris, you know, whatever, Gudinov, to understand
right.
who you're really talking about. But in some books, I found that very difficult in the Russian books. However, in this book, it made some sense, and I enjoyed meeting all these other interesting people, which are part of the texture of your family in your
yeah.
book.
Yeah.
But at any rate, your choice of stories and vignettes helps to bring out this relationship that you've described between nature and yourself and your family. And as I say, there's another book here. Think it over. I'm going to encourage you, because I want to find out what happened to Joe. And I want to find what happened with Brett and,
yeah.
and Dean and Nancy and all these other folks that have new lives as a result of
yes.
the transformation
yeah.
of your father.
Yeah.
So.
And they really are new lives. They really are.
Mm-hmm.
Our lives now are different because we got a few good years with our dad who we always loved, but suddenly felt like we could express
mm-hmm.
a fullness of actually being a family.
How many times, I leave this to my audience's own thoughts as they're listening to this, how many times have we looked back at an age, whether it's 20 or it's 100, and said to ourselves, gee, I wish that I could go back and do this other step,
right.
take another path
right.
than the one I took, or that another path would have been offered to me.
Yeah.
And the truth of it is, without those other steps that maybe came along that were painful at the time, you wouldn't be the person that you are.
No.
You wouldn't have contributed to the, in this case, the body of literature of a family and the ecology that you have.
Yeah. When my father passed, my brothers and I had very serious conversations about, aren't we so lucky because there was nothing left undone with Dad.
Dean Kuipers, thank you very much for joining us on With Respect. It was a most interesting conversation, but the book was very interesting.
It was a pleasure to be here, John. Thank
Good.
You.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday, Saturday, and Thursday. And until next time, remember our motto that if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.